connectedness to eternal realities. This type of approach can be cultivated. It can be and must be cultivated alone. It can't be done in group form. For the growth from within out is everyone's personal journey. Others can inspire us, perhaps, to attempt it, or can tell us, well, how they're getting along with how they're doing it. But each person must make that journey for themselves. And it's nice to believe that in order that this journey may be as useful, practical, and simple as possible, that a period of life is set aside for it. That this period of life comes as a natural development of the maturing instinct in ourselves. This change in our life pattern has been intimated by Carl Jung in his psychological writings, that gradually the individual of themselves and of their own purposes begins to drop away from the false values that they've lived for most of their adult years. They are no longer interested in being foolish. They are no longer finding the satisfaction in selfishness. They discover that revenge is no motive that produces anything worthwhile. And self-pity is about as poor as any of them. All these things mean nothing in the form of growth or happiness or security. Therefore, the time is given to us, sometimes maybe 5 years, 10 years, even 20 years, in which to really experience the growth of an inner nature, a growth that is no longer directly interfered with by the complex and competition of economic life. In retirement, the individual is in a sense partly free from the pressure of the sterility around him. He has an opportunity to think his own thoughts, to be himself, to make his own plans. And these things should be done properly and with insight and with definite realization of value. If the person begins to think about straightening out his own character, he will gradually find that he has found an avocational interest that is better than any other. But at the same time, he is not supposed to sit around all the time thinking about his mistakes or planning for some invisible future. What he is supposed to be doing in his meditation is releasing his real self to discover what his purpose in space is, where he came from and where he goes, and why at this moment he is where he is, and what this has to do with the past and how this is overshadowing the future. A study of orientation sometimes, as I've known on a number of cases, leads to a new friendliness that was never present before. Suddenly the person has no enemies. They have no adversaries, for they have discovered that their problems were within themselves. Also in this type of life, there comes a certain necessity for a judgment and to a measure for adjustment with another world beyond this one. Little by little, the material consciousness disentangles itself. It gradually separates from many of the pressures that it once knew. Now, this separation is not in the form of loss. There is no sense of loss. It is merely a problem of dropping some ballast that we don't need. It gradually becomes obvious that if we would travel far, we must travel light. Too many burdens of thought, too elaborate establishments to keep up, too many duties to do the material things, these become unreal. Reality shifts from what we have to what we are. And when this happens, we've made a very great step into the future. Because after all, the great step is to the unfolding of the divine potential within ourselves. If we are searching for God and searching for truth, we must finally turn that search inward into the deepest parts of our own natures. And many have done this with great success and have enjoyed it immensely. If a person in good middle life, with family responsibilities and so forth, suddenly desires to leave the world of material things and enter monastic orders or something of this nature, he may do so to escape responsibility. He may be making a very serious mistake. If, however, his responsibilities are finished, as in older years, he then has a perfectly proper right to direct his attention upon the internal life of himself. Under those conditions, the monastic life may come, but not at a time when he should be taking care of his material obligations. So we can divide life, like the mysteries of the ancients, into three essential steps or grades. The first grade is that of physical emphasis. In the first grade of life, we pay the debt that we owe to the world and to our own parents and to the circumstances around us. Other people are helping to make our life possible. They are helping to give us an education. They are providing us with as much health and happiness as they can. They are guarding our well-being with certain solicitude. Therefore, these things all constitute a debt. And this debt we sometime must pay. So whereas the first third of life is to learn and to become capable of manifesting the full measure of our potential, then comes the second part of life, in which it is our duty to make payment for what was done for us. As we were helped by our parents, so we become parents to help our own children. As we have carried the responsibilities of learning, so we must pay these debts and must perform our part of maintaining the economy and the survival of physical society. So in the second third of life, the individual goes into business, earns his living, pays his debts, raises his children, and becomes a householder. Now, a lot of people now feel that the householder is some kind of a profane thing, that he should try to dodge all these responsibilities and make a solo flight to nirvana. This is not very practical, however. We do not accomplish by evasion or by neglect. The development of the householder and his duties are just as sacred as any other part of life. The individual who doesn't pay his debt to society with a good grace by doing those things for others that others did for him is missing the entire meaning of religion. He is living a very selfish, self-centered life, and he is not supposed to do this. He must pay his debts as he goes along, and to avoid the payment of debt is a moral sin. And especially this is true in connection with his responsibilities to society. This means also that in these years, he is permitted to have all natural and proper happiness, all things that are useful and proper to his family. He can know the affection of parents, know affection of the marriage partner, understand the love of children. All these things are part of domesticity. And this is the second step in the mystery of growth, that these things should be proper. Therefore, the individual who on small count breaks up a home or refuses to accept the responsibilities because he wishes simply to enjoy life himself at the expense of other people, he has flunked the second test. He is not doing what he's supposed to do. He cannot solve this by going to church. The only way he can solve it is to do the thing he is supposed to do, the thing that is his proper obligation in life. Failure to do that and hope for spiritual achievement goes out the window. He must grow. Life is a growth. And no one grows by becoming an alcoholic or a narcotics addict. No one grows by spending everything on themselves and ignoring those who are dependent on them. And no one grows by making a home no one can live in. This type of thing is the part of the second path. It is a test. It is a probationship, which is the proper term for it. A probationship is a period of testing. It is a period to prove that you are worthy of what comes next. And if you have weighed in the balance and found wanting, you will go no further at that time, at least. You may have to wait for other embodiments in order to make any further progress. Because if we are obedient and faithful unto small things, we will be made masters over greater things. The tendency now is to forget the small things, ignore them, and make mad dashes for some kind of happiness that has little or no significance. If, as a householder, you have completed your labors, if your children have grown and are on their own, self-supporting, and the husband and wife are facing the future together, then there are two ways they can go according to the Oriental path. One is to retire into an ashram or go into a seclusion somewhere or join a religious community or settle down to the reading of sacred scriptures or perform pilgrimage or do anything that they feel is right, often including a dedication of service to orphans and to the parentless, those who have lost everything, to God and help the suffering, to give peace to those in trouble, but absolutely no longer any emphasis upon self-achievement in worldly things. On the other hand, if the person doesn't wish to do that particular thing, he can simply retire into a proper hermitage or a quiet place and there commune with life and commune with nature. He can allow himself to be rewarded for the fact he has kept all the rules. But he is not there just for the purpose of being comfortable. He is there because he realizes that within himself is something that all this evolutionary process is all about. That somewhere within himself is this growing thing. He realizes that in childhood or youth, he didn't understand this thing and couldn't do much about it. In the maturity of life as a householder, he had to sacrifice his own good for the service of other people. Now, however, freed of this, he sacrifices his own good for the glory of truth. He settles down to understanding the best that he can his right place in a universe that goes on and on. He wants to become adjusted to the divine plan, a plan which will always be a threefold plan. As he goes on, he will go on to learn again, he will become a householder again, and he will retire again. But in each embodiment, he should do it more wisely, more lovingly, and with greater insights. Every decision of life depends upon insights brought forward from previous embodiments. As these insights improve and grow and strengthen, they are available to add more substance to future lives. Now, the person then becomes a kind of, well, integrated subject of life. Now, in our Western way of life, we can't probably do quite these things, and it may not be that we should, but we have not had the background training. We have not been brought up in a broad sense of responsibilities. We have not been taught from the beginning to develop our own characters. We have waited for other people to shape them for us. Also, in our various forms of employment, we have never really experienced the mystery of relationships. We have never really understood how the divine plan works out on every professional level, on every trade and business level, in every craft. There isn't a thing we do in this world, from the most abstract banking down to hoeing in a garden, that is not some manifestation of universal law. Everything is part of something else, something bigger and something more complete. Today in the West, we haven't the eyes to see the divine purpose behind the commonplace. In fact, we take many glorious things and interpret them as commonplace, which is a serious mistake. But anyway, we are going to go on and carry these problems with us. And we are going to try the next time we are a child to be a better child, to be a truer and more faithful friend, parent, and relative, more helpful. Not necessarily just simply a doting child, but a cooperating one. A child that even in its early life helps the family problems. Finds full satisfaction in being useful in the household instead of thinking of every possible way to escape from it. So by degrees, our childhoods are changed by rebirth and by experience, by meditation, and by contemplating the consequences of our own conduct. Then as we go further into the household stage, we carry each time something we have learned from the past. Perhaps we will have had from the past the realization of the tragedy of a broken home. And we will try to prevent it again. We will do what we can to be more patient and more understanding. Perhaps in the past we had a good home, but it was damaged by war and catastrophe, and we had to face the problem of surviving the losses of the very natural occurrences which make life significant and valuable. All the way, we have to learn to accept, interpret, and use everything that we have known. We will also be more patient and kindly in the problem of supporting those who depend upon us. We will gradually learn that it is our duty to meet every responsibility we have assumed, and having committed ourselves to a responsibility, that we shall fill it at all cost. This becomes more and more obvious as time goes on, and today we have homes of different values all over the world. There are many wonderful homes in which those who have brought forward the experiences of the past have learned how to make a wonderful home. There are others which are very brittle and temporary and have very little substance because they are the result of a life still undisciplined and dedicated and unaware of the realities. So finally, as it comes to the meditational part of life, we find various ways of working with these subjects. We find opportunities to help society. We help to help underprivileged nations, to take care of those in burden and in sorrow. And if our intelligences and integrities are sufficiently developed, we may be able to become in public a leader in some field of reform or revitalization of virtues. All these things are part of a cycle. And it is in the period after our retirement from the business world today that we really have a chance to think about these things. We have a chance to do our own dreaming, do our own building, and also to watch every day for opportunities to learn more and to understand better. We find out gradually that while we started out in life perhaps to criticize a lot of things that we didn't believe in, that by the time we retire, our tendency to criticize is considerably reduced. Probably one good of rule on that is to come maybe in the maturity of our years to the realization that everyone, or nearly everyone, is doing the best he can for what he is. And it is that for what he is that is the big catch in the question. We expect more from people than they are. That doesn't mean that they should not be more than they are. They should be. But if they have not achieved it, then from what they are, they move. And their actions are often very unpleasant. But we have to understand that behind all unpleasantness, there is a life locked in that unpleasant person that is just as beautiful and just as wonderful as that of the greatest canonized saint. It just hasn't come through. And we must try in all ways to recognize that what hasn't come through, we must encourage in any way that we can. And what we cannot encourage, we should suffer as quietly and patiently as possible. Now, another problem that confronts these older folks is failings of health. After a while, somewhere along the line, the body doesn't respond as well as it used to. The body, instead of being a vehicle, becomes a prison. And of course, we can look back, and many people do look back, and realize that they helped to build that prison themselves. The failure of the individual to keep the laws of the physical health is just as detrimental to his body as his breaking the moral laws is detrimental to his morality. The body is a very useful instrument, a wonderful power, and it should be treated with as much natural respect as possible. Always served wisely, never spoiled. Always in every way possible, maintained as a priceless asset, something that has made it possible for us to have all the learning, all the thought, all the affection, all the progress that have been given to the world for thousands of years. We then say, well, if that's all true, why do we have so much trouble in this world? Why are people so often incapable of reacting to the better side of themselves? That, again, is a problem that we have to go back into rebirth to find the answer. There are some who are simply not grown up. There are a great many human beings in middle life today who are spoiled children. There are some who are just barely out of infancy, and yet they may consider themselves great people and hold public office. They just don't realize that maturity is not something that is measured in terms of years or in terms of the formal education or the business experience that we have. Maturity is an unfolding of value within ourselves. An individual who is mature does not do things which damage himself or others. He chooses his arts, his interests, his hobbies, his avocations, and his pleasures from among those things which are constructive, useful, and in some way advance his own aesthetic and moral conduct. Maturity, therefore, is something that you cannot measure in terms of physical years. And we have to recognize that every individual who falls short of basic integrities is immature. Every person who is selfish is adolescent. Every individual who finds pleasure in the sufferings of others is infantile. The things have to remain. These problems occur. But the wise person who is trying to grow tries to understand them and not let these delinquencies affect his own integrities. He must realize that because others are dishonest, this does not justify dishonesty on his part if he knows better. We must live on the level of our convictions. To compromise them is fatal. If we compromise them too much, we can destroy the mind, the emotions, and the body. If we neglect the body, it sickens. If we neglect the emotions, they become bitter and cruel. If we neglect the mind, it becomes critical and harsh. Therefore, to keep all these things in a good condition so that we can learn something every day and grow every day, we must watch and discipline our own conduct. And in the last years of life, we can pull all these strings together and make one solid pattern out of them. It's not that we are leaving for either forever or for some distant and unpredictable future. We are just going out to the next step in our own growth, and we might as well be prepared to recognize that until we grow, we continue to suffer the absence of the growth that is necessary. The individual is, we say, looking for happiness. Now, happiness is not something that can be measured exactly in terms of our lives as we know them. Happiness is the reward for doing right. Happiness is something mysterious that puts all things in order if we live as we should. There can be no true or lasting happiness apart from maturity of emotions and minds. Happiness can be contentment for the moment. The alcoholic thinks he's happy if he's intoxicated. But his intoxication is a false happiness. And any type of happiness that is based upon false values will ultimately break down. So all through the time we have in life, we can look back and we can say, I knew Jones. I know what happened to him. I'll never forget the bad time a sister had on a certain occasion. I can't forget the problems we had with the children, nor can they forget the problems we had with the government or with the community or with the neighbors. And we can't forget the fact that we were overcharged, underprivileged, and exploited. All these things come back in our older years. But with them comes perspective. The moment we can look back over 60 or 70 years of things happening and re-happening, we will begin to see what's coming through the pattern of the divine purpose. If we don't see that pattern, then all this living we've done is in vain, and we will leave this world embittered and disillusioned to come back and fight it out again. But if we are enlightened, we will see by looking back hundreds of examples, hundreds of proofs of the importance of values, of the significance of what really works, what really is accomplished in life. We'll begin to find out what really made the most of life for ourselves, how we got along the best, how we were able to hold our friends, how we kept the love of our relatives, how we kept the laws of our land. All these things come back, and little by little, we find that this perspective spreads. You can't get a good perspective on life unless you work out where it came from and where it goes from here. You can't get a proper perspective on the destiny of humanity unless we realize that it comes in with unfinished business and it goes out with unfinished business. No one is going to accomplish all of it in any one lifetime. We are bringing into life problems that we haven't solved. We take out with us problems we haven't solved. But somewhere between birth and death, some of these problems should be solved. There should be advancement of some kind. There should be at least a 1% improvement all around. If there isn't, then we're in a serious problem. And for many people, there isn't a 1% improvement. They are more disillusioned than when they leave than they were when they came in. Nothing has satisfied them. Life has been miserable, largely because their own personal ambitions were frustrated. They tried to be happy, but didn't try to make anybody else happy, so everyone was miserable. So these things we have to learn. And we can, by looking back upon the experiences of life. We can also look back upon great art. We can look back upon wonderful music. We can find all kinds of social and human values that have come down to us. We can appreciate the achievements of creative genius. We can also recognize how very simple and humble things brought us the greatest comfort and security. We can remember the Walden of Thoreau and the simple poems, the very beautiful poems of Emerson. We can find all kinds of achievements, and our lives can be rich with constructive ideals and deeper types of thought. All these things all add up to a little confusion when you start on it. Some of them will tumble over each other, some of them will frustrate each other. But out of a long year life, there should come a pattern. A pattern that is our pattern. And yet at the same time is not really ours, because it is the pattern of everything that lives. But we have adapted it in our own way to our own need. And if at some time along the way, we're a little careless and a little thoughtless, and we reach our 70s and we say to ourselves, I've not been the genius I thought I was, or I've not been the great soul I believe myself to be, there is probably still another 10 or 15 years to make more progress. We can begin at that point to make those changes that we know we should have made when we were young. And we realize finally that nature is perfectly willing to accept it that way. Nature is perfectly willing for us to become enlightened when we can, and in whatever way is possible to us. And if we solve a problem now, we won't face it again. If we correct a fault honestly and sincerely, we will not again have that fault to bother us. But to correct a fault does not mean to say, I shouldn't have done it that way. It is a deeper feeling of realization of a mistake. It is also a deeper recognition of what would be necessary to correct that mistake, and a resolution not to make that mistake again. Perhaps in the course of this type of reverie, if you want to call it that, you might pick up the telephone and talk to someone in a kindly way that you have not spoken to for 20 years, simply because you had a feud. But unless the thought of doing it better produces some kind of tangible result, it is apt to be forgotten. It is apt to be passed over lightly when the times of testing come. But if we really do something, we can say to ourselves, all right, I really did do that. I found him, and he hung up on me. He wasn't at all interested in renewing the acquaintance. When we hung up on you, that was his problem. when you found him, that was yours. And the fact that you tried and sincerely made an effort to the point of doing something, there was a certain tiny modicum of advancement here. There was something that's a little better, and you have overcome a deficit in your own nature. Now, there are large deficits and small ones. One of them, the common kind that we find a lot, is difference of opinion in religion. Many people grow up in a conservative religious home, perhaps very orthodox, or they grow up in a home where there isn't any religion at all. But regardless of these two extremes, each individual has to make his own peace with truth. If he doesn't, he's going to be in a bad way. And always we have to realize that religious sectarianism with religious conflict, religious intolerance, and religious bigotry are something that we must all face in ourselves if it happens to be our problem. If we have a kind of mind that is unable to go over the boundaries of our own creed to see good in anything else or anyone else, or we begin to think of ourselves as saved because we have a belief, whereas somebody else with identically the same belief isn't saved because he doesn't belong to our faith. This type of thinking is something else we have to get over. We have carried religious intolerance in this world for thousands of years, and it is obvious from experience that it is one of the difficult things to get over. It is something that it has taken ages to get even to the point where we are now. Therefore, it's true and something we have to face, that unless we are able to do better, unless we are able to overcome these intolerances in ourselves, the religious conflict will go on to the end of time. But if we begin to correct ourselves, the conflicts will cease. Therefore, wherever we see a social evil, something that is wrong in society, and we recognize that it is wrong, then we must try to cease practicing it ourselves. We must not add to that which obviously is a desperate dilemma for humanity. We have crime, we have war, we have all these things that prove that the human race has not yet outgrown deficiencies within itself. If it has these deficiencies, it is quite possible that each of us share to some degree in these deficiencies. We also, very likely, have not come to a dynamic solution of problems. We have not found the religious tradition that is proper and right in each other. We have not allowed ourselves to be at peace with the God of all peoples. We have the same problem in racial situations. We have it in all kinds of arts and sciences. We have modern artists we don't appreciate. We have modern music we don't think anything can appreciate. But all these things represent rebellions, represent efforts to escape from something. And wise people don't make these strangely disordered and distorted escapes. Wise people, finding something that they can't stand or do not like, go to work on themselves. They either learn to give other people a right to like as they please, or if the matter is one where actual difficulties or dangers are involved, the individual takes his own position and refuses to be overwhelmed by the things around him. If we can start building good, we will find evil gradually vanishes. If we start living together in a cooperative manner, many forms of crime and delinquency which are based upon competition and discord will fade away. And as we gather to see what we're going to leave behind us when we go, it is a very wise thing to try to prove or see in ourselves these laws operating. That no matter what we think or how we feel, there are great patterns of reality that we cannot change. We are part of those patterns. We come and go with those patterns. And while we are here and able to breathe, we should do all we can to become adjusted with that which is essentially right in life. And after we get to the point of reminiscence, after we get to the point where we're no longer vitally involved in the conflicts of life, we have a right to sit back and think about it and try to see if we can't leave this world at peace with all things here and with an eager and open heart to go on to that which is next according to the divine plan. If we do that, we'll get along somehow. Okay, thank you very much.